All rise. Court is now in session.
A verdict in this case has already been decided, but I'd like to examine this case together. And then I would like you to ask yourself, what if? What if this person really is innocent? What if the jury got it wrong? Could this crime have occurred as the state said it did? I suppose it's possible. But isn't it also possible that this is one of the many wrongful convictions throughout the United States? Prepare yourself to be amazed, disappointed, and perhaps outraged at what you're about to hear. I'm Deborah Fulton, Case Review Manager for Wrongful Convictions News, and I would like to present to you some of the factors used to obtain a guilty verdict, and then you can decide if you would vote to convict or acquit. On last month's episode, I told you that Haman Lee's life was tragically cut short and that her ex-boyfriend, Adnan Syed, was convicted of her murder. We discussed Hay's current boyfriend, Don, his fishy alibi, and the lack of investigation into him. I also talked about Jay Wilds and his multiple version of events, as well as the possibility that police coached Jay throughout his taped interviews. Today, I want to delve into the evidence and the autopsy results. Hay's body was found on February 9, 1999, in Lincoln Park in Baltimore, Maryland. It was determined she died by strangulation, probably manually, meaning with hands versus no instrument. However, that wasn't conclusive. There was a rope-type thing found near Hay's body. Sometimes it's referred to as a rope, sometimes a wire. Whatever it's called, it had unknown female DNA on it. Unknown because it doesn't match anyone in the databases. It may or may not be involved in Hay's murder, but it's certainly interesting since it was found near her body. I've also recently discovered that there is unknown female DNA attached to Hay's fingernails. And that's huge in my opinion. Anyone that pays attention to true crime knows that DNA could be from Hay's real killer or an accomplice. In addition to other untested evidence, there was also a liquor bottle found near Hay's body. It did contain DNA, but it was never tested. Why wouldn't they test any and all items found near a murder victim? Interestingly, when investigators did test the t-shirt that was found in Hay's car that had her blood on it, the analysts noted that the seals on the containers of DNA for both Hay and Adnan were broken. No DNA testing was done prior, so why were those seals broken? This calls some things into question, most of all, chain of custody issues with that DNA. Speaking of evidence, it's too bad police didn't investigate this case more thoroughly. Remember that an 18-year-old high school girl went missing from the area about 9 months before Hay. It's not a stretch to think these two similar-type murders could be connected. Jada Lambert disappeared while driving to her job at a nearby mall. Jada was found in a park that wasn't easily accessible by vehicle. She was manually strangled, and her body was found after an anonymous caller contacted police. There was also a liquor bottle found at Jada's crime scene. This young lady was murdered by a man named Roy Davis. He wasn't found to be Jada's killer until after Adnan was arrested, but he definitely should have been investigated thoroughly. Isn't it possible that Roy Davis intercepted Hay during her travels, strangled her, then dumped her in a park, just as he did with Jada Lambert? Too bad all of the DNA evidence in this case hasn't been tested. Let's move on now to the lividity evidence, which completely negates the state's theory and Jay's stories. One of the things that Jay is consistent about is that he saw Hay's body pretzeled up in the trunk of her car and that he and Adnan buried her at approximately 7 p.m. on January 13th. But neither of those two things are possible. The lividity evidence shows otherwise. Livor mortis, which is Latin for bluish color of death, also known as lividity, is the reddish-purple discoloration of the skin after death due to the pooling of blood based on gravity. Lividity becomes fixed, or permanent, after approximately 8 to 12 hours. This means that if you were to move a deceased body before it's fixed, lividity would shift and resettle. Medical examiners can then determine if the body was moved after death. If a body is moved after fixation, no shifting or resettling would occur. When the medical examiners disinterred Hay, she was laying on her right side, only partially covered with some leaves and dirt, in a depression near a log. Hay had fixed frontal lividity, meaning after death, she was lying face down, prone, rather than curled up in the trunk of a small car. It also shows that she was most likely deceased for 8 to 12 hours before she was buried, and not only 4 to 6 like Jay states. If Hay had been buried within those first few hours, her lividity would have shifted to her right side after burial. The state's whole case was based on Hay's time of death being between 2:20 and 2:36 and her burial in Lincoln Park around 7 p.m. This lividity evidence completely contradicts that timeline. Additionally, there are some double diamond-shaped impressions on Hay's shoulders, which indicates that wherever she was lying, she was resting on an object or objects that left these impressions. The impressions are approximately 2.5 inches tall by just over an inch wide and look like two diamonds stacked on one another. Some have speculated that they could have come from a concrete grinding block or grinding shoe. Again, to review, the lividity evidence plainly shows that the state's timeline is wrong. She was not buried at around 7 p.m. on the 13th. Now we're going to talk about Adnan's alibis, plural. Adnan had asked Hay at the start of the school day if she could catch a ride to track practice. Again, not an unusual request, and she gave him rides often. However, she later told him that she couldn't do it because she had something else she had to do. At around 10:45 that morning, Adnan offered his car to Jay so that Jay could get his girlfriend Stephanie a birthday gift. They met up, and then Jay dropped him back off at school sometime around 11:30, with the understanding that he would pick him up after track practice. After school, Adnan went to the Woodlawn Public Library, which is next door to the school, and then went on to track practice. There are a few things that make this day, January 13th, stand out to this group of friends and acquaintances. First, it was Stephanie's birthday, and second, it was the day after Jay's birthday. This was also 2 days before Hay and Adnan's friend Krista's 18th birthday party. And, probably the most significant memory, was that it was the day before a bad ice storm, which occurred in the wee hours of the 14th, shutting down schools for 2 full days, giving students an extended long weekend. That's what clicked for Asia McLean when she wrote her letters to Adnan, explaining that she remembered seeing him in the library after school on the 13th.
I was sitting in the library bored to tears, and someone walked in that I knew. I asked him about his breakup with Hay. She was dating someone else, but that he just wanted her to be happy. He didn't seem to be disturbed or angry with her.
Asia went to Woodlawn and knew of Adnan and Hay, but wasn't particularly friends with either of them. Asia distinctly remembered having a conversation with Adnan and that her boyfriend was late picking her up. Afterwards, her boyfriend was annoyed with her for talking with Adnan, and she was annoyed that he was late, so they argued. She remembers this detail because she got snowed in with him and school was canceled for the next few days. The most important thing here is that he and Asia were in the library during the time the state said he killed Hay. After Adnan's arrest, Asia visited his family and explained that she saw him at the library, as did her boyfriend and his friend. Then she wrote letters to Adnan himself. Adnan gave the letters to his attorney, who never contacted Asia.
To not ever contact Asia McLean, to never find out if her story helps or hurts your case, that makes no sense whatsoever. That is not a strategy.
Adnan's attorney by this time was Christina Gutierrez. She told Adnan that she had spoken with Asia, but she was of no use since she had the incorrect dates. There are notes in the file confirming that Adnan gave her the letters, but they never actually called Asia. Gutierrez lied to Adnan about this. I can't express to you how sad and mad this makes me. If Asia had testified about this at trial, it would have completely negated the state's timeline, and we would most likely could have seen an acquittal. If Gutierrez's team would have bothered to look for security footage at the library, or maybe computer login records, they may have had proof of his alibi. No one bothered to check with his email provider either. Instead, Asia and the alibi were pushed aside until much later when Rabia spoke with Asia. And Asia wrote out an affidavit saying she saw Adnan in the library and that no attorney ever contacted her. From what I understand, Christina Gutierrez was, at one time, a top-notch attorney, at least back in the day. However, she had multiple sclerosis, which became worse and worse as Adnan's case went on. Not only was she becoming an inadequate attorney, but she was also becoming dishonest. She was actually disbarred due to some other cases, and she since passed away. After Gutierrez, a new attorney joined Adnan's team, Justin Brown, and his investigators reached out to Asia. But Asia refused to speak with them. She had called the prosecutor, Kevin Urich, to ask why anyone was contacting her on Adnan's behalf now, after all this time. She just assumed that her testimony wouldn't have meant anything at the time, so why was it important now? She had faith in our system and thought they must have proof that Adnan did this crime. Well, Kevin Urich basically dissuaded her from cooperating with Adnan's team by stretching the truth about the case and Adnan's guilt. He told her there was DNA evidence proving he did it, which is a lie, by the way. So she chose not to speak with Adnan's defense team. She thought that was the end of it until Sarah Koenig from Serial Podcast tracked her down and told her about Kevin Urich's own trial testimony. During that testimony, Urich said of Asia and her affidavit, quote, "She told me that she'd only written it because she was getting pressure from the family, and she basically wrote it to please them and get them off her back," unquote. Asia was shocked by this and determined that she needed to follow through with setting the record straight. So she wrote another affidavit saying she did not feel pressured, nor did she recant her first affidavit. So, after Adnan left the library that day, he then went on to track practice. This is particularly memorable because, again, it was a warm day in January, so they had practice outside. The day before was also warm, but they had a meet that day, so the 2 days couldn't have been confused with each other. Coach Sy and Adnan both remember the 13th, since it was during Ramadan, and therefore Adnan was fasting. Adnan was allowed to walk the track rather than run, as the rest of the team had to do. The two also had a conversation about Adnan leading prayers at the mosque. After track practice, Jay came and picked up Adnan, and they went and smoked some pot together. Later, Adnan dropped off Jay, picked up some food for his father, and brought it to the mosque, where Adnan stayed until approximately 10 or 10:30 that night. Numerous people saw Adnan at the mosque, so Adnan seems to have a pretty tight alibi that no one really bothered to check out. You know what else no one bothered to do? Obtain Hay's pager records. Hay didn't have a cell phone. This was 1999, when cell phones were just becoming more common. She had a pager, but police never obtained those records. If they had, we would probably know what she was going to do between the time she left school and the time she had to pick up her cousin. Remember, something came up that she had to do. Not only do we not have her pager records, police never found her pager either. And Jay has never once mentioned her pager in any of his stories. Chances are, whoever killed Heyman Lee either took her pager or destroyed it. Now, you'll remember that I said the timeline of a 7 o'clock burial came from cell phone records. Adnan's cell phone received 2 incoming calls that pinged a tower at 7:09 p.m. and 7:16 p.m. Police interpreted that tower to be located near Lincoln Park. First, all of the cell phone evidence was presented incorrectly to the jury. The maps shown were incorrect, but truthfully, the maps were shiny and probably couldn't be seen very well by the jurors anyway. But they were incorrect. The cell phone tower presented was one that didn't actually cover the burial site on the map. Most importantly, was that with the cell phone records was a fax cover sheet with instructions for interpreting them. The
The records themselves were entered as Exhibit 31 at trial, but did not include the fax cover sheet. This fax cover sheet contained a disclaimer that said, quote, "Outgoing calls only are reliable for location status. Any incoming calls will not be considered reliable information for location," unquote. That disclaimer was included in all of AT&T's communications with the Baltimore homicide detectives for this case. So to break that down, incoming calls aren't reliable for location, but the state was using the incoming calls to prove Adnan was in Lincoln Park. And it appeared they purposely didn't include the instructions for reading the records, not even to their own expert. Before trial, the expert only saw one page of the records. Somewhat recently, this expert signed an affidavit in which he wrote, quote, "If I had been made aware of this disclaimer, it would have affected my testimony. I would not have affirmed the interpretation of a phone's possible geographic location," unquote. So, again, the state's timeline depended on this detail, and this detail was not fully legitimate and could have been disputed if presented properly. While I'm discussing the prosecution's, let's call it, devious handling of this case, I want to talk about the night that Adnan was arrested. Adnan was arrested at his home at about 6 a.m. on February 28, 1999. They brought him to the police station and started questioning him. He was 17 years old and alone with the police. His parents immediately retained attorneys Douglas Colbert and Chris Floor. Colbert called the station at 7:10 a.m. and spoke with a sergeant, telling him that he was Adnan's attorney and requested all questioning stop. At 10 a.m., Chris Floor called and spoke with a detective who informed them that Adnan was, in fact, being interviewed. Floor asked to see Adnan immediately but was told no and that questioning would not cease. He said that Adnan would be allowed to see his attorneys only after the interview was over or if Adnan specifically asked for his attorney by name. Floor told the detective that since the family retained him, Adnan didn't even know he existed. The detectives still refused to allow them to speak with Adnan. Next, both attorneys drove to the police station and at 10:55 a.m. asked to speak to their client. The officer relayed the message to a detective who relayed back that he, quote, was not taking any visitors. The attorneys then called the homicide division and spoke with another detective who told them that Adnan waived his right to an attorney. This kid was 17 and felt he had nothing to hide since he was innocent, and so he waived his right to an attorney. The attorneys were told that the interview would continue, and unless Adnan requested them, they wouldn't be stopping. Finally, Colbert asked them to videotape the interview, and the detective again refused. After that, the attorney asked that Adnan's parents be allowed to see him, and that request was also denied. So, at about 2:30 p.m., the attorneys faxed a letter to the detectives requesting to see their client and to cease speaking to him. I'll also note that during this whole ordeal, which was over 8 hours long now, the only thing given to Adnan was a drink of water. While technically, I suppose it's true that Adnan waived his right to counsel, so they did nothing wrong, but morally, these detectives, I don't even really have a word for it other than despicable. Adnan was 17 years old, a juvenile. But you know what? Adnan said nothing incriminating. He spoke with them for hours, but never said anything that gave them any indication that he was involved in Hayes' murder. One of the things the detective showed Adnan while speaking to them was a document that said capital crime and eligible for the death penalty. That's when it really clicked to Adnan that they thought he did this. When he went for his first bail hearing, conveniently, Adnan's date of birth was listed incorrectly on the charging document. It listed his year of birth as 1980 instead of 81, making him 18 instead of 17. The judge kept referencing this as a capital crime, which it wasn't since Adnan was a juvenile. Even during his second hearing, when the date was corrected, the judge still denied bail, and one of the main reasons is because Adnan is Muslim. Yeah, illegal, but that's what happened. the prosecution presented a report from a cultural expert that basically listed some unfair stereotypes of Muslim relationships. Then the prosecutor told some untruths that she later apologized for, but of course, by then it was too late. The kicker, though, was when Adnan's community all gathered in the courtroom. In addition to Adnan's parents offering their home for bail collateral, three other community members offered up six different properties for collateral. The prosecutor said that was all the more reason to deny bail, since these people would be willing to help Adnan flee the country. She went on to say that Adnan had an uncle in Pakistan and that he could make people disappear. This infuriates me. First, Adnan had an expired passport that he was willing to give up, even offering to block ever receiving a new passport. Second, he was born and raised in the United States. All of his ties were here. The prosecutor said that it would be so easy for him to go to the Pakistani embassy to obtain a new passport. Adnan had already been accepted to college, so his attorneys were hopeful that he could finish high school, then start college while all of these court proceedings were taking place. But that didn't happen. Adnan was denied bail. Statistics show that people who are denied bail are less likely to be acquitted since they aren't able to assist with their defense. His first trial ended in a mistrial because a jury member overheard the judge calling Christina Gutierrez a liar. Unfortunately for Adnan, those jury members were pulled afterward and at least up to that point in the trial said they would have voted to acquit. His second trial ended with a guilty verdict. Basically, the prosecution presented the best story. Christina Gutierrez was even more ill at the second trial and her defense was lacking. She never presented an alternate story or alternate suspects, and there were plenty of those. Adnan was sentenced to life plus 30 years, and Jay Wilds received no jail time at all. Adnan was a juvenile, sentenced to life for a crime I truly don't believe he committed. I know many people think that an older juvenile should be tried as an adult, but I don't agree. Developmentally, 17-year-olds are still, well, kids. The United States is the only country that actually sentences juveniles to life sentences. And let me remind you, there is zero physical evidence that implicates Adnan in this murder. There was no DNA linking Adnan to Hay, no fingerprints, no evidence in either of their cars linking him to the crime. Soil samples didn't match anything belonging to Adnan. There was nothing. There was not a single witness that saw Hay and Adnan together after school. There were no witnesses that saw them leaving the parking lot together, or Adnan getting into her car. There was nothing that ties him to Hayman Lee's murder, for that matter. The only piece of evidence that suggests that Adnan Syed is the one who murdered Hayman Lee is the testimony of Jay Wilds. Instead, there is some unknown DNA and unidentified fingerprints, as well as some female DNA at the scene and under Hay's fingernails. After Jay Wilds himself told investigators that he took part in the burial of Hay, the prosecutor arranged for an attorney to represent Jay pro bono. The prosecutor arranged for an attorney to represent a witness slash accomplice for free. I have a very hard time wrapping my head around that. This is unheard of. Then, a former prosecutor, Thiru Vignaraja, who was running for state's attorney while he was representing the state in the post-conviction relief hearings against Adnan Syed, was doing so pro bono. Yes, for free. Ever hear of a former prosecutor arguing for the state pro bono? Anyway, Thiru's former campaign manager said something interesting in the HBO documentary. She said that she asked Thiru why he just didn't test the biological evidence in Adnan's case. She made the point that if he's so sure, why not test it and put the doubts to rest? His response was that it wasn't the prosecution's job to test the evidence. What? The prosecution's job is, in fact, to find the truth and seek justice for all involved. In this case, Hayman Lee was a victim of a violent crime, and he didn't think it was his job to test the evidence, thus finding out the truth? But that's a great example of the must-win attitude that prosecutors have. Now I want to talk about Hay's car. Jay is allegedly the one who led police to her car. He said that after the burial, he and Adnan took the car to a grassy parking lot in some row homes. He said that they parked the car on January 13th and it had been parked there until February 28th. If you look at the photos of her car, you may see that the evidence doesn't particularly coincide with that story. First, there's a lot of green grass showing in the photos, both under the front of her car and the side. I would think that between the ice storm and the month and a half of being under a car, that grass would have turned brown. Now, there is some brown grass, but if you look at the empty spot next to Hay's car, that whole spot is brown. Additionally, there is a lot of grass and dirt on the tires of her car. Again, with just that one ice storm, I would think at least some of the grass and dirt would have washed away. It, along with the tire tracks, looked too fresh to have been sitting there for that long. Which brings me to Irene. Irene is a woman who lived in one of those row homes. Private investigators spoke with her during the HBO show, and she told them that there's no way that car sat there for several weeks without her or a neighbor calling police. If a car sat for a while, they called it in and it would have been towed. She wasn't at all wishy-washy about that either. She said someone would have called about that car being there, period. When police finally did recover it, they didn't process it at the scene. Instead, they towed it, then processed it, which is not really standard. I would be curious to know the position of the driver's seat. Was it in a position where Hay would have kept it, or was it moved back for a taller person? One thing of note in the car was that the ignition collar was missing. The ignition collar is the silver ring around where you insert your key. That's something that gets removed when someone needs to start a vehicle without its keys. Also, one of the things that Jay said in one of his many stories is that Adnan strangled Hay in her car and that she kicked the windshield wiper wand, breaking it. Sounds pretty specific, right? Something that could easily be corroborated? Well, first, the car was released to Hay's family before any of that was documented, so there's that. When they finally got around to videotaping the inside of her car, on March 16th, they had to go to a body shop where her family left it to get repaired. The ignition collar was already fixed, but that windshield wiper wand was indeed broken. Except, it wasn't really broken, like from a kick or an impact. Instead, it was just loose. They actually had an expert look at it to find out if it had a break, but it was determined there were none. It's a good story, though. One that easily could have come from the police if they had just maybe looked inside the window of the vehicle, or perhaps even if they drove it. Finally, after many ups and downs and several petitions for post-conviction relief, Adnan was granted a hearing. In 2016, Adnan's attorneys argued about the ineffective assistance of counsel for the claim of Christina Gutierrez not calling Asia as an alibi witness, as well as not cross-examining the cell phone expert properly. In June of 2016, Adnan and his supporters were overjoyed with the ruling. Adnan was granted a new trial. This decision was on the basis of the cell phone tower evidence, but not Asia's alibi testimony. But the state appealed this decision. That appeals court upheld the ruling, but flip-flopped on their reasoning. They ruled for the alibi claim, but not the cell phone tower evidence. Either way, they were granting Adnan a new trial. However, the state appealed it again, this time to Maryland Supreme Court. On March 8, 2019, that court reversed the whole thing and are now denying Adnan that new and fair trial. They basically rejected both of Adnan's claims. And while six of the seven justices on the court found that the failure to contact Asia was deficient performance, four justices found that this failure was not prejudicial. So that was a huge letdown, and Adnan remains in prison. Adnan then filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, but they denied hearing the oral arguments. That's not to say he didn't have a strong argument. It's more that they only hear 1% of all cases submitted. The U.S. Supreme Court receives about 7,000 to 8,000 cases and really only hear oral arguments for maybe 80 of those cases. Adnan's attorney, Justin Brown, said at a press conference, quote, "The point I would like to make is some things are bigger and more important than technicalities. We've got someone who's sitting in jail right now, and we're asking for a new trial, unquote. This is something that I've always said. It's so easy to wrongfully convict someone, but nearly impossible to right that wrong. All they want is to have a new and fair trial for Adnan. They aren't just asking to set him free. They want a new trial. He deserves a new trial. The state offered Adnan a plea deal. They offered for him to serve 4 more years in prison, but he would have to plead guilty, and he refused to take that deal. He said there's no way that he would stand up in court and tell a judge and his family that he took part in this horrible crime, because he didn't. Doing so would be telling a lie. In the HBO documentary, The Case Against Adnan Syed, we hear Adnan himself say, quote, "When I was a kid, they threatened to take away my future, to take me away from my family, take away the opportunities I would have to go to school or to get married and have kids, just to have my freedom. And they made good on that threat. Now, it's a lot different. They don't have anything they can take away anymore," unquote. Adnan doesn't have the life he thought he would, but he does have a life. He has a job and friends and a routine. He's doing the best he can with what was handed to him. Unfortunately, we're in the midst of this pandemic, and I pray every day that he will stay safe and healthy. One of the things that Adnan and his family want, other than his freedom, is for his story to be heard. Anyone that is wrongfully convicted wants to be heard. We encourage you to watch the HBO docuseries The Case Against Adnan Syed and listen to Season 1 of Undisclosed Podcast and Truth and Justice Podcast. If you have time, listen to Serial first. Educate yourself. See for yourself that he really is innocent. Then, create a ripple effect by sharing his story.